So protocol support, we already did an LS with parentheses and it displayed all the different packet types. And depending on your SCAPI version, it's always getting updated. It supports hundreds of different types. And then we're doing an LS on a specific protocol, in this case, IP, and we see all the fields and we looked at that already. Another thing I'll point out before we continue, if we do LSC and parentheses, that shows us all the functionality built into SCAPI. Like you saw us do send receive one. Well, that's going to be in this list and it will show us information about what it does. And some of the other ones here, like send receive P, which means send and receive packets at layer two. Now, if you do a P, it's going to expect you to have crafted up a layer two header. If you use the P option and you didn't craft up a data link layer header, it's going to send a packet out with no layer two header, which isn't going to get very far. If you just do SR without the P, then it just uses your MAC address information accordingly to, for whichever interface you're using. So what this slide is showing us here is something I'll just show in an example. If we say P equals, and I'll create a packet at layer two. So if we go back out to the slide, you can see that we can use ether to create that layer two header. So I'll say ether, and then we'll set the destination to equal FFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFF if we say p.show, it shows us the destination, the source, and the type. Now, a couple of things to notice here. There's a destination field and a source field, and then type. Type is not going to be set, really. It's just a raw, you know, layer 2 packet right now. But if we layer on an IP header, Scapy is good in that it will go back in and update that field for us with the appropriate indicator for IP, which is actually quite useful. If you have to actually go and put that into your code, it's going to take a lot more code to do so. Same thing with calculating checksums and such. So also the destination field, we saw that there's a destination field in the IP header as well. So that's what I want to kind of show here. So I'm going to go layer on a IP header, and then we're going to go back and look to see if it changes the type first. So we'll say p/=IP, destination equals 10.10.10.10, and we set that. Now let's do p.show again. Here you can see that it's gone back and updated the type at layer 2 to 800 to indicate that layer 3 is IP. So very useful. Now, pointing that out again with the destination field, there's a destination field there in the Ethernet header, and there's also one down there in the layer 3 header for IP. But if I say p.dst, it just shows me the first hit, the first instance. What we can do is jump down a layer using the payload operator. So p.payload, it's going to jump down a layer, .dest, and that shows us the layer 3 destination field instead. We can also use more of an array notation and say p, and then in square brackets specify the layer. So I can say ether, and then .dst, the field name, and it shows us that. We can change this to IP, and it shows us that. So a couple ways we can go about doing that. So creating packets, we've been doing this a bit already. On the right there, you can see we're creating some DHCP packet. And again, we can pretty much do anything we want. Scapy's got all the templates we need. And this just shows us again where we're looking at destination fields and using the different syntax or notation options to be able to view specific fields or make changes to them. And I'll show you a couple more examples here in a moment. So inspecting packets, let's look at that. So if I say p.summary, does that do anything? It just shows us a summary there, not so much information, just high level. If we say P, it shows us pretty similar information. P.show, we looked at that already. That shows us every field in the packet. One that I like to do is ls and give it the variable name, and it shows us over on the far right what the default would be, and then next to that to the left, it shows us what we've changed it to. So it's kind of like the template versus what the actual packet looks like. Another option is hex dump. And then we can give it the variable name, and it shows us a hex dump of our packet, which is useful. And then we can even say Wireshark, and then our variable, and it'll come up and show us what it looks like in Wireshark here. And there's our packet. So a lot of options. All right. So sending packets, you saw before we did a LSC with parentheses and we had all these different options like sniff and send receive or send SR1, SRP. And we talked a bit about this already. Send is just going to send out the packet and it doesn't try to record any responses to that packet. SR means send receive. We're recording the response back and we can assign those responses to variables and we'll do that here in a moment. SR1 means only record the first response that comes back. SR without the one says continue sniffing until you get a response to every packet that you sent out. So if you don't get a response to every packet, it'll just continue to sniff unless you use some of the timeout options or the count options where you're telling it to stop after a certain duration of time or a certain number of packets that you receive back. So a bunch of different options there. You'd want to look at the help menu for those particular commands, those options. Let's look at an example of creating a little port scanner, and we'll do a couple of things here. So we saw earlier we sent a packet out on port 80 to the target system, and we just recorded the one response. Let's change this up a little bit. This time we'll say P equals, and we're just going to overwrite the existing variable, IP, so we're not going to mess with the data link portion or the Ethernet header. Destination equals 10.10.10.70, and then we're going to layer on a IP header. This time we'll say TCP header. This time we'll say destination port equals, and then inside a Python list, 80.443, let's do 21 and 666. So this is the web server that we use in class. We're not expecting many of these to be open, if anything besides 80. We'll see what it comes back with. But that's like we can create a little port scanner here. And we're going to create two variables, answered and unanswered, equals send receive, and then we'll basically say P. What this is going to do is it's going to send out the packet with, well, four packets actually, and it's going to, any synax we get back or any ACK resets as well, it'll assign to the answer variable. Anything that we don't get a response to will stay with the unanswered variable. So we run that, and it says finish sending four packets, received five packets, got four answers. And so we got asterisks. Let's take a look at the results here. We'll say answered.show, and it comes back and shows us we got a SYNAC back on FTP. We got on HTTP. We got a SYNAC back on HTTPS. We got a SYNAC back, and then we got resets back on FTP and a reset back on port 666. So pretty neat. We got a response on everything that we sent out, and that's why it stopped so quickly. If we didn't get a response and just nothing came back from one of these ports, then Scapy would have continued to hang open and we would have had to hit Control C to have it stop. Another thing we can do here, actually, let me hold off on that until we get to that slide, which is the next slide, so perfect timing. This example, Tim Medin, who's a SANS instructor, he's a guy that came up with Kerberos hosting and all, he ran a scan years ago, a Nessus scan, and it caused a Citrix server, TFTP service, to crash. So he just used Scapy to craft up a TFTP packet and saw that when you sent a read request with 400 A's, that it caused a crash to occur, as you can see in the slide. Now let's craft up a TFTP packet real quick. So here I'll say, and we'll see what it looks like in Wireshark. So P equals IP, and we'll set the destination to equal 10.10.10.70, even though I know that TFTP is not open on that system, it's fine. We just want to look at the packet. And then we'll layer on a UDP packet and set the destination port to 69, because that's for TFTP. And then we'll layer on a TFTP packet. Then we're going to layer on a TFTP read request. And in here, we'll set the file name to equal A times 100. And look at P. So there you can see it's all sorted out. Now watch what happens here when we open it up in Wireshark. It says malformed packet DNS because by default, Scapy sets the source port to 53 because it thinks it has a better chance of getting through a firewall. So Wireshark's getting confused and it sees this as a DNS packet and not a TFTP packet. So if we close that, let's go in and change the source port in the UDP header. So to do that, we'll say P, and we'll use that array notation, UDP dot source port equals, let's just change it to 8888. and that should be good. We open it up in Wireshark again, and now it sees it as a proper TFTP packet. So pretty neat how you can craft up if you know which fields to use. Obviously, you might have to go look at the RFC or look at the fields and the names of the fields inside of Scapy, but you can craft this up, validate that it looks good, and then go ahead and send that out on the wire. So Scapy in a script, it's just showing you an example where we can, from Scapy.all, we can import specific protocol or packet types, and or we could just import everything. And we've got our sys.argv check going on to make sure that we are sending in an argument. So it says if the length is not equal to 2, print out the usage statement. And then we've configured the verbosity to 0, so we don't want to have extra data that we don't need displayed. Answered unanswered variables, and we say send receive P, so we are going to include the Ethernet packet or header, and we've got it set to a broadcast. We're layering on an ARP header, and then we're taking in the argument from argv1 from the user to populate there as the destination. And then we set the timeout to 2. So after 2 seconds, if we don't get a response, terminate. And then any hits we get back, we're going to use a special Scapy notation to print out the MAC address and the IP address using printf or sprintf. So packet capture interaction. Here at the top, we're saying packets equals read pcap. That's another Scapy function that's built in. You would see it with LSC. And we're saying read in.pcap. Once it reads it in, we hit packets, and it gives us a overall summary. We can see we got 195 TCP packets, 57 UDP, and some other ones. Now we're saying packet offset 0. So go to the first packet, look at the DNS query record, and it displays that. And then we can open it up in Wireshark. Next down, we've got configured the interface to Ethernet 0. You can set the tap 0, whatever you want. Packets equals sniff. When you get 10 packets, stop. So count equals 10. And then we say packets, and it gives us a summary. And then we can write those results out to a file called out.pcap. On the bottom there, that looks similar to something we did in the crypto section in day 2 or book 2. We're saying fp variable equals open the payload.dat file and write binary mode. Then define a function called handler, take in an argument packet, fp.write, typecast a string, and then jump down a couple layers, write the results out to this file. And then we're saying sniff offline from a file existing called in.pcap, pass each packet to a function called handler we already talked about, and it's going to write those results to that payload.dat file. So this screen is something that Josh Wright came up with a while ago, where he took a modified wireless access point, and the idea was, can we sniff remotely? Like, say, for example, you're in a company and you plug this access point into an Ethernet port on the network. So it's a wireless access point, but it's plugged into the network, and you're telling Scapy, sniff from the Ethernet interface, so that's the input interface, Ethernet 0, and then output interface is MON 0, so wireless. So then you see at the bottom, sniff function, store equals 0, don't store any packets, pass each packet coming into the inject function, and sniff from the input interface, which is Ethernet 0. So sniff from the wire, pass each packet you see to the inject function, then we put a fake MAC address on with dead beef, and then we send that packet out via the wireless interface. So we layer on the radio tap header and .11 header, and we send that out with the MAC address of dead beef. So now you could sit out in the parking lot or remotely and sniff based on that MAC address, and now you're sniffing off the wire, but wirelessly remote. So it's pretty neat. You'll actually work with that particular, the result of that script executing in the extended hours or bootcamp section, where you'll be asked to do something, and we'll get back to that later on. So Scapy and IPv6, it supported IPv6 for quite some time. We took a look at that header already. So the good thing about this is, since it understands a lot about IPv6, and a lot of IPv6 tools out there have not been, or stacks have not been tested very well, like IP version 4, there's a good opportunity to try to find vulnerabilities with Scapy. So here at the top, we're simply loading the kernel support for IPv6 in case it's not already there. And we're creating basically an IPv6 ping packet. That's all we're doing, is sending out a ping packet. And the second example down, we're just doing the same thing, but doing that port scan like we did earlier, but with IPv6 addressing instead. So router discovery, we talked on book 1 about how we could use IPv6 to do man-in-the-middle attacks, doing neighbor solicitation attacks and also route solicitation attacks. And this is just an example of doing that. You can see in the code, we're setting the Ethernet address info, the destination and source. We're sending out a FE80:1 packet type, and the destination is FE80:2. So source is :1, destination is :2. And then we're sending out a neighbor discovery packet. And you can see what we're trying to do here is get a response back or trick the network that we are in fact the router that should be their preferred router. And then we can forward things on to the real router accordingly. So we're just kind of get into the middle here and responding back. So this one is a well-known resource exhaustion IPv6 trick, and it affects a lot of operating systems. Some were able to fix it to some extent, some were not, but like Windows 7, for example, this is pretty big impact to it. All it's doing is sending out a packet that has a random source MAC address, and you can see that in the code, and then it sends out a random IPv6 prefix. So we're sending out router advertisements with the random MAC address as a source, and then we're just randomizing the route advertisements. And that's causing interrupts to occur on the target, and it's basically going to do tons of, again, interrupt, and it's going to cause a lot of kernel code to execute, and it may or may not store this information in kernel memory. So let me show you an example here before we go to summary of this executing. So here's that script, and I've got it on my Kali system. I just wrote it up real quickly, and you can see it's doing the exact same thing. Now, we're using send p and then loop equals 1, which means continue to send this in a loop. Now, I've got my Windows 7 box over here on host-only mode, so we're going to bring up Task Manager, and we're going to look at performance, and you can see everything looks good on this system right now. The CPU utilization is low. We'll go back over to Kali here, and now I need to set myself over to host-only mode so I don't do this to my active network. That would be bad. So host-only mode, and then we need to get an IP address. So once we get that, I'm going to go ahead and send out these advertisements. All right, we're good. So Python IPv6, let's go. What's wrong here? No module named all. What I might need to do here is either try running this from inside Scapy or switch to a different Kali system with a different version of Scapy that I had. So let me cat that out again. We'll try to execute all this from inside Scapy. So let's do that. I'm going to go back and forth between these two prompts. And if this doesn't work, I can try a different Kali system. All right, so I'm going to be lazy and just copy and paste all this. I think this is going to be the problem here, actually. But let's just see if we can skip that. I hope this works after all the copying and pasting. So send p packet loop equals true. And let's hope this works. There we go. So let's go take a look. I'm just going to let that run for a moment, and I'm going to stop it right now. 660 packets is pretty convenient. So we go over to the Windows 7 system and look at its CPU. So it's at 100%, and it's probably not going to come back anytime soon. So if you did this on a LAN full of Windows 7, Windows 8, certain Windows 10 systems, it's going to drive the CPU up to 100% like that. So at this point, I'm probably going to have to revert that back to snapshot, but we'll let it go for a little bit. So let's go back over here and just drop out of Scapy. So in summary, Scapy, as you can see, very powerful and flexible tool for packet crafting. It's just a lot of fun. I mean, you can do anything, as you can see. It even if it knows you're wrong, it'll just let you craft anything up. And there's a lot of really good sample scripts and stuff out there that you can take a look at. That one I just showed you is a fun little one to try out in a lab. Just make sure you're in host-only mode and you're not hitting anything else. I do it in a lab environment as well. So at this point, it's time to get to a Scapy exercise. So what you'll be doing is on your network across VPN, you're going to go after the server 10.10.10.68 on port 53. And the goal is to find out where someone named Jimmy Hoffa is buried. So that's in root secret.txt. You want to use the command injection bug to cat out that file. And there's three different options you have. I'm going to show you the simple option here in a moment, which is you can send an interactive packet and just examine the response. Advanced, you can write a script to exploit it and parse through the DNS response to make it look a little nicer. And then the elite option is to simulate a remote command shell. And solutions for all three are available. So here it's just going to show you, you know, play around with Scapy a little bit and try talking to the remote server using the DNS query record. And it shows you some Wireshark stuff. Here's the vulnerability disclosure, and this tells you what the problem is. And so you read the vulnerability. It logs the contents of DNS queries with an invalid type record to a file, but does not validate the input. Any DNS query that uses a type of 32 that indicates a leading semicolon in a hostname portion will result in code execution. So that's what you need to remember and what you need to craft up, the type of 32. So it tells you stop here. So if you don't want to see one of the answers, you would want to pause right now and go and try it, which I recommend that you do. Otherwise, we're going to walk through now. So here, interacting with the DNS server, it just shows you using dig some things you can do, but it doesn't support options like AAAA records and such. So you're going to need to use SCAPY to do that and not dig. So here we're saying LS DNS query record, and we can see there's a QName field, QType, and QClass. So we're setting RD to 1, QD to DNS query record, and then QName equals, and you can see we're doing a semicolon and then an LS afterward. And our QType equals 32, which is what the vulnerability disclosure said you would need to do. So let's go over here to our Kali system, and I'm going to get back on the network. So I've got to change back over into bridged mode. For my end setup anyway. And we'll do an ifconfig eth0.10.10.12.12 netmask. All right, let me just make sure I can ping it. Good, I'm on the network. Let's go into SCAPY. And here we'll just say payload equals DNS, and then RD equals 1. And again, those fields come from the SCAPY fields, and you can also get help for that if you don't know what they mean. QD equals DNS query record. And then QName field equals, and this is where our command injection opportunity is, semicolon LS. I'm going to close that one out. And then our QType is going to equal 32. So that looks good. And then we'll say header equals, and this is the easy part, IP destination equals 10.10.10.68 for the target. And then we'll layer on a UDP header. And of course, the destination port is going to be 53 for DNS. And then we'll close that one out. I messed up. Let's see. What did I do wrong? There we go. So SR1, send receive 1, header, and we'll layer on payload, and that should be it. So look at the result. We get that nice LS out there. And then, of course, what it told us to do is to cat out the file home or root secret.txt, I believe it was. So let me just double check so I don't type the wrong thing. Root secret.txt. So root secret.txt. And now let's say send receive. We see our rname is there, but it doesn't dump anything out. Let's go back. So payload equals that header again. I'm not sure why it's not putting that out. Let's see if the command works again. Single command. Oh, you know what? cat /root/secret.txt. I'm only doing these things because I know that some of you would accidentally make that mistake as well, and I don't want to make you feel bad. No, I'm just kidding. Easy to mess up your syntax. So let's go ahead and try that again. There we go. And it shows us Jimmy Hoffa is buried in the Netherlands complex, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, that is the purpose of the lab. I'll go ahead and close that out now. And that would take you to the end of the exercise. And next we'll move on to fuzzing. We're now going to spend the rest of the book on fuzzing and code coverage, starting off with an introduction. So in this module, we're going to define what fuzzing is, recognize some requirements that we need to have to ensure we're successful, and then various techniques that can be applied, and then what types of things we want to test. I'll also show a quick demo of a fuzzing tool called TAOF, or TAOF, stands for the Art of Fuzzing, and it's a simple mutation fuzzer, just again to show you a demonstration of something that was written by a developer to do a specific thing, and some of the good things about it, and then the limitations. And then we'll work our way into the Solly fuzzing framework, we'll talk about BooFuzz, and then continue on with AFL and such. So first off, what is fuzzing? I like the definition on the top here. It's a testing mechanism that sends malformed data to a well-behaved or well-behaving protocol implementation. In other words, developers should be following what's stated in something like an RFC or some other set of requirements, and ideally they code securely, but of course functionality is critical. And so if they follow what it says in something like the RFC, let's take an example of Trivial File Transfer Protocol. It's a simple one. And with TFTP, it tells you things in the RFC, like every packet, every data, it should be 512 bytes. It should not exceed 512 bytes, with the exception of the end of a stream. And there's other things in there like the TFTP command option. So hexadecimal 0001 means a read request. Hexadecimal 0002 means a write request. And there's 03, 04, 05, and there might be 06, but it's pretty much limited to those five or six. And those are like the request types. And that would be the very first portion of the packet in the UDP payload. And then that would be followed by something like the file name, if we're going to get something, and then a null byte, and then a mode, and then a null byte. So these are all things I remember from looking at TFTP in the past. And my point being that a developer should be reading through those requirements and implementing that. And of course, that can be written up in any language. And so if they make mistakes, so they use stir copy to copy the file name or something like that, then there's probably a buffer overflow opportunity. So that's the kind of things that you want to look for. You want to know all the different languages that they could have used to write that server or client, and then all the ways specific to those languages that mistakes can be made and how you would go about testing those mistakes. That would be kind of fuzzing and fault injection. We want to automate, like have a script that just continuously sends these malformed requests to try and trigger a fault. Or we can do it statically as well. But that's kind of the idea behind fuzzing. And this can be applied to network applications like an FTP server or a web server. It can also be applied to binary input files, things like a Word document or a PDF document or JavaScript inside a browser, those types of things as well. So more of like network application fuzzing versus file format fuzzing. It's absolutely a research technique that's shown great success. It's no one's going to argue that fuzzing is an invaluable resource. So it's something that others will argue, if you do a good enough job in static analysis, that you shouldn't have to necessarily do dynamic analysis and fuzzing. And I don't agree with that, because some of the bugs are so complex and they're difficult to find without dynamic analysis, where a source code scanning tool like Fortify or another one, they'll find the low-hanging fruit, and they also find a lot of false positives. Or manual code review is very time-consuming. And even if you do manual code review, when you're talking about complex C++ code and you've got all these modules being loaded and things, you can't plan as a developer for every possible condition under which your code is going to run. So therefore, when you get into, like I mentioned in an earlier module, or maybe I didn't, but I'll mention it when it's appropriate. But you talk about something like C++ bugs with use after free, and you're talking about these complex objects that are created, and there are references to these objects, and it's difficult to track that kind of stuff. And if someone's able to prematurely decrement a reference counter in an object, and it garbage collector comes in and gives it back to the heap manager, it's going to result in a use after free condition potentially. And it's, again, difficult to find that with static analysis. So I'm just arguing with myself basically and stating that there is no replacement for dynamic analysis and fuzzing. It's something that should absolutely be part of your development life cycle. So as it says on the bottom, essential part of SDLC, your secure SDLC, your SecDevOps or DevSecOps, whatever, and you want to make sure you're mapping in things to each phase, like your requirements phase and your design and your implementation and verification. If you're like waterfall, or if you're agile, you need to map things into each sprint or each bucket practice, and you need to know what goes into each phase. Like, you want to make sure when you're compiling the code that you're using the right exploit mitigations, that you're checking for banned functions that should never be used, that you're doing some manual and static analysis, especially on areas crossing trust boundaries, or when you compile the code, that you then go and do dynamic analysis, or when you're looking at your design phase, that you're doing threat modeling and attack surface reduction. All those things are very important. So the value, we apply it to evaluate software for faults. You know, it's kind of similar to QA, but QA is typically looking at the user experience, and they want to make sure that there's no latency issues and just bugs that are causing the experience to be degraded. It's not something that the QA folks are looking for vulnerabilities. They're looking to trigger crashes or, again, testing the user experience, but doesn't really go beyond that. So we need to do the fuzzing to look for crashes that especially could be weaponized. It can certainly be white box or black box. White box would be source code assisted fuzzing, and we're going to talk about that with our code coverage section. Black box would be, well, we don't have the source code. So we can do block analysis and other things, but it might take us a little bit longer. We got to do more reversing, but there are techniques we can use, and we'll cover both. And absolutely, fuzzing is used by good, bad, and everyone in between. So for requirements, we need preferably documentation. I want to know what I'm fuzzing. I mean, if it's truly black box and you just don't know what it is, well, you're going to have to do more reversing. But you're hoping you get things like debugging symbols. You're hoping maybe there's an RFC or some set of requirements that you can look at to kind of understand what the goal or objective was when developing this application. Absolutely, one or more targets. You know, you can set up a little fuzzing farm and have multiple instances of the same application or applications that you are testing and run pieces of the test to each one at the same time. And that way you can speed things up greatly. Tools, you want to have a fuzzing framework that you can use or tools that you've written yourself or by others. You want to have monitoring, and that's a critical part. Imagine just a bad analogy where if there's a homicide and there's no cameras there, there were no witnesses to see it, so they don't know who did it, who committed the act. So the forensics analysts come up afterward and they take their photos and they do their testing. But without having any footage or witnesses, it's going to be a lot more difficult to figure out who was the culprit. Similarly, here with fuzzing, if you run a fuzzer and it's randomly sending data to a target and the target crashes and you weren't monitoring, well, you have no idea what mutation or what malformed data caused the crash to occur. And if it's random data that you were sending, you may never hit that condition again if you start it over. So you want to have proper monitoring. And also time, patience, and creativity. You need to have time. You can't expect to run a fuzzer and have that fuzzer get instant results. If you're someone who likes instant gratification, which we all do, of course, fuzzing is not always going to be that. You're probably lucky if you get a crash pretty quickly. And you may be fuzzing for hours or days only to realize that your fuzzer really isn't even working properly. I've had that experience many times. You're not even getting through the front door of the application, and that's going to get us into code coverage and things like intelligent mutation fuzzing to try to prevent that from happening. But you need time. There's no way around that. You can speed things up by having multiple instances and validating that your work is good, but it takes time. You need to be patient because it takes time, and you need to be able to go in and modify your fuzzer and be creative to make sure that you are getting good code coverage. And again, that's why we have that later on, that whole code coverage section. So with fuzzing, with all of that being said, another thing, I'll just give another analogy. Let's say that you are new parents and you have a child for the first time, and everybody pretty much who has their first child goes through this, where when your baby is sleeping, you're constantly checking on them. And some parents probably stare at the video screen on the baby monitor. And if the child even hiccups, you know, they're going to, what's wrong? And they're going to run in there and check it. Like, you're not supposed to stare at your fuzzer while it's running the whole time. And I'll bring that back up when we get to Sully, but You want to make sure it's set up and working, and you want to go in and check on it every once in a while to make sure it's still working and all is okay. But you don't want to stare at it. You know, you have other things to do. And the idea behind fuzzing is you can let it run and you can go work on other stuff, right? So you want to be considerate of that. So fuzzing techniques, various methods. Programming's not mandatory, but you're going to be limited, right? You're not going to be able to go and extend anyone else's fuzzer or framework or write your own. And I'll tell you, when I first started, it was definitely using other people's fuzzers and getting frustrated because it wasn't doing what I wanted it to do, but not having the experience for that particular language to go in and easily modify it. So you pretty much got to just pay your dues and learn the language and learn how to do it. And then you start writing your own and using these frameworks when you can. It doesn't matter what scripting language, but certainly some languages are more friendly towards things like security research over the years, and scripting in any language, really. So techniques, there's instrumented fuzzing as one option. Let's take a step back, though. There's some basic forms of fuzzing, like randomized fuzzing. That's where you're just sending random data. There's not much intelligence built into that. And you may not be able to recreate the condition, and that's why monitoring is so important, that that maybe caused the crash. So there's also mutation fuzzing, which I'll show you with a, an example with a tool called Delph soon. And mutation is selecting fields and mutating through a certain number of, a finite number of mutations based on certain bug classes like command injection and overflows. And then it stops. So I'll demo that soon. Then you can get into like intelligent mutation fuzzing, which we'll get into with the Sully fuzzing framework. And there's also static test cases where you can kind of come up with a one-off static test case. Say, for example, you capture a packet that's going to a server, to some network application. You could edit that packet with a hex editor and try to look for, maybe you have identified a field inside and you try to test for a buffer overflow. Just an example, but that's going to be time consuming as well. So instrumented fuzzing, this is what we'll talk about with AFL a little bit later on. And this, it's source code assisted, typically, and you're able to compile it in a special way so that you can track when a line of executable code is reached. And we'll talk about how that works a little bit later on. And also, we could potentially have an automated way to come up with test cases and mutations that can be sent in and monitor the whole thing. So an intelligent mutation fuzzing, like we'll do with Sully soon, this, it takes a lot of upfront time because you need to know what you're fuzzing. So you've got to go read the RFC if it's something that's been standardized like that. And you've got to write your fuzzer in such a way that it makes sense to the target and you're getting through the front door deeper into the code. If you just send random data, it's going to be very limited code coverage that you're going to get. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time here talking about intelligent mutation fuzzing because we've got the Sully module coming up after this. So what to test with fuzzing? In fact, let's stop here for a second and I'm going to go over to my system and we'll take a look at that tool TALF that I mentioned. So I've got it set up here already on this Windows 7 system and you can see on the left it says TALF TA0F and I've installed something called the 3COM daemon and that's a 3COM server. It's got a FTP server, TFTP, syslog, and a bunch of stuff, and it's vulnerable to a buffer overflow condition. So that's going to be my target. Now, the cool thing about TALF, and I'll pull it up, it's a standalone executable. That's what it looks like. It's got a proxy built in. So it's limited, but it does some really cool stuff. It's got this proxy built in where it can capture data. So it requires less, I don't want to say intelligence because it said intelligent mutation fuzzing a moment ago, but this is not an intelligent mutation fuzzer. You don't really have to know anything about what you're fuzzing because the proxy will capture data going back and forth at a server, and then you can select fields where you want to fuzz. So let's set up the proxy first. I'll say settings, TALF settings, and this just shows us time on information and time between requests, which is important because you might want to slow things down if it's too fast for the server to be able to keep up with it. So let's close that, and we'll click on data retrieval, set our proxy settings. Our local server, 0000, is fine. Local port, we'll say 2121, because we want to fuzz FTP, but we want to hit the proxy port first. So our remote server is going to be our local host, and then the remote port is 21. And then we'll go ahead and say start the proxy up. And now we're going to go and grab, or get up the browser here, and I'm going to try and FTP to my local host. So FTP 127.0.0.1 on port 2121. And we get a prompt. I'll just put in monkey as my username and banana as my password. We log on. It fails and I'll just close the browser out. We'll stop the proxy. And now you can see we get some hits here. We see user monkey. We see a password of banana. So the buffer overflow is in the user command in FTP. So I'm going to set fuzzing points on that. Now what this is doing, you can see the ASCII says user space monkey. User is the command. And monkey is the username that I put in. And then up top is the hex ASCII and then followed by the carriage return line feed at the end. So if you just hover over all of it, it just automatically sets the fuzzing points from the offset zero on forward. And you can change that to what you want. And then over on the right, you can see the different types of conditions it's going to check for, like string overflows, integer overflows. So I'll leave that set to the default. We'll add that in as a fuzzing point and we'll say okay. And now we can click on fuzzing and we can start fuzzing. And then that will continuously send the requests that we captured with the proxy, but it will mutate through that field that we selected. That's why it's easy to use because we don't have to know anything about what we're doing here, which is kind of dangerous. But I'll also bring up Immunity Debugger at this point, just to show you that we'll attach to the target process, which is the 3Com server, and we'll see what it shows when we fuzz it. All right, so we've attached to it. Let's go back to the fuzzer, and we say start. And pretty quickly, we get a crash, and you can see that the instruction pointer points to 41414141. So we triggered a buffer overflow. If we close out the debugger and we go to the file system, a new folder has been created called fuzzing session, and it shows you the request that the proxy captured, and it shows you a file called debugging. And if we open up the debugging file with Notepad, you can see it's showing you all the requests that it sent. And it says, check this out carefully. This request killed the service request 512 characters. So, you know, that doesn't mean that's exact. You'd want to use a pattern create script that we'll talk about in book 4 to go further with this. And feel free to do that when we get to those sections. But just wanted to show an example of a basic fuzzer and the kind of things that you can do with it. But that's limited because we don't really have control over what exactly we are sending. If it's something more complex and we've got to compensate for a bunch of different metadata fields and things like that that have to be there, this isn't going to be able to help us so much. So back to the slides, what to test with fuzzing. Intelligent mutation fuzzing, this is going to be much more useful to us because we can select those specific fields where we want to mutate, and we can leave other fields alone as static. And again, we'll get to that more in the Sully section coming up next. Randomly inserting data into those fields is going to have limited options because it's limited success because it's not any rhyme or reason to what it's sending. It's truly random data and it's going to infinitely run. And if you just happen to get lucky and the random data it generates causes a crash, you better hope that you monitored that and you were able to capture what exactly was sent to cause that crash so that you can replay it. So some examples of things we want to test for: signed and unsigned integers. So a signed integer can represent both negative and positive values, and an unsigned integer can only represent positive values. So the most significant bit in this, an assigned integer, you can call that the signed bit, where if it's on with the 1, that means the value is a negative. If it's off with a 0, the value is a positive. An unsigned integer can use all 32 bits in this case, 2 to the 32nd power, or 4.29 billion. And so what happens a lot of times, you will see memcopy involved in many bugs out there. And it's not memcopy's fault, it's the code's fault. Memcopy expects you to give it a positive value. It expects an unsigned integer. It does not want a negative value because it will treat it as a positive value. And think about what negative 1 looks like as an int. It's FFFFFFFF. Well, what is that if it weren't a negative value? Because it's negative 1 is a negative value, but if it's an unsigned int, that's 4.29 billion. So if memcopy somehow gets negative 1, it's going to think that's the size and you're going to have a problem. An integer underflow, it's a simple example here on the bottom right with the code where we've got this character array of 16 bytes. We've got a signed short named index, and we've got this little while loop down here. It says while the index is not equal to 0 and index is less than 16, go write the data. Now, negative 1, negative 2, negative 3, that's not 0, and it's also less than 16. So that's going to get an opportunity potentially to read or write out of bounds depending on what's going on. String overflows, we just saw that with the example with 3Com daemon. It's just sending really long strings, typically A's is what's used. Why A's? Because why not? And also A in the ASCII range is hexadecimal 41, which is typically not a mapped virtual memory region within a process. So if it ends up somewhere, like in a register where that's being read, or the address is being read or written to or executed, it's probably going to cause a seg fault. Field delimiters is another one. If you look at the example get and then /http/1.0, what are the delimiters there? Spaces, slashes, maybe the dot? I mean, there's a bunch of examples. And if you look below, where it shows server and date and other items, there's just lots of delimiters everywhere, less than, greater than, equal sign, quotation mark. So the question is, what happens if you exclude one of those delimiters, or if you swap out that delimiter with something else, or you repeat it? Think about what the code's doing. It's simply parsing through this metadata. It's expecting to see certain things at certain places, and it runs these validation routines, or it's supposed to. If those are not written properly, then you could cause a crash to occur. directory traversal is another one. So that would say in this PHP code up top, we're saying a variable my file equals /webroot/files. And then we're concatenating on this file name. Well, where's the file name coming from? And if a user is able to enter that file name, and if they put ./.. you know, Etsy shadow or something, they might be able to read out of bounds. So you want to make sure you're filtering out anything that could be potentially harmful there. Command injection is another one, and you just did this recently with the Skippy lab, where the system function, if it's executing something on the server side and there's no input validation or cleanup occurring, they're filtering out harmful characters depending on the language that's being used, like ampersand and semicolon and pipe, then someone might be able to append on an additional command and do command injection. So this slide says your turn. It's a Wireshark DHCP capture. And over on the left, you can see how Wireshark is decoding it. And if you're looking at all those lines there, just taking a quick look, because you can't fuzz everything. Does anything stick out as something potentially interesting to fuzz? And if you start at the top, you go down like message type. Well, boot request, one, that's a message type. What if we give an invalid message type? Or hardware type, same thing. Hardware address length. Or what if we change the length? A lot of times if there are two lengths within the same block, there might be an opportunity for an integer underflow or overflow. And you could just continue to go down and try different ones. Like what about boot file name not given? Well, if there is a boot file name, is there a buffer overflow there? So just the kind of things you'd want to think about. So in summary, that's just a quick introduction to kind of what we're going to be moving onto with labs coming up with Sully and others, and just some of the things you'd want to test, some important things you need to have, like monitoring and of course, patience and time and creativity. And we looked at a nice example of a mutation fuzzer. Let's continue with building a fuzzing grammar with the Sully fuzzing framework. So what we'll do in this module is we'll explore Sully, we'll talk about how it works, we'll finish up talking about a tool called BooFuzz because Sully is no longer supported and BooFuzz is, and I will do a demo of Sully, and you'll actually be doing this lab that I'll be demoing in the extended hours or bootcamp portion. So Sully is a fuzzing framework written by Pedram Amini and I believe Aaron Portnoy as well, and no longer maintained, sadly, but it still works very well, and it does a lot of things that we can leverage it for in building different fuzzers. Now, as I mentioned, since it's no longer supported, someone else had taken over, and I forgot the name off the top of my head, but we've got it listed when we get to that slide, and doing some great things, but there are some limitations and some things that aren't working quite the same way that we want to see them work with Sully. So that's why we're going to stick with Sully in this course and the lab, but we will talk about BooFuzz, and you're certainly free to go and investigate that, because I'm sure it will improve going forward. So on this slide, we've got a Wireshark capture of HTTP GET request. And on the right, you see a snippet of a Sully script. And what we're going to do is kind of go through this module, walking through how do we get from the left to the right. So how do we take something like what we see in a network capture or an RFC and then create a usable fuzzer in Sully? So you can skip over on the right. Don't worry about what all that says now because we're going to walk through it. So leveraging Sully, again, it's a framework. You still have to write the fuzzer, but you can leverage all the libraries and modules and work that's been done for you. And Sully is a really cool part of Sully is for network protocol fuzzing. It delivers the mutations across the network for you. It monitors the target responses, which we said is really critical. It logs traffic. You can do things like control VMs if you've got the right version of VMware to reset the target. It assists a little bit in the analysis of crashes. There's limitations there, but we'll take a look at that as well. It's again written in Python. It's open source, so you're free to go in and work with it. It works on Linux or Windows, but it's got more power on Windows, and you'll see why as we go through. So some drawbacks. It's a intelligent mutation fuzzing framework, so therefore it's going to be time intensive. You've got to spend the upfront time getting to know what it is that you are fuzzing. Otherwise, you're going to have really limited results. There are minor bugs. We fixed a bunch of bugs to get it to work on your Windows 10 system, and you're free to download, of course, the original one, but we fixed some things so you have a better experience, and that functionality is the best on Windows. So we're going to use a Windows example and a Windows web server to fuzz.